KPFA. Thomas J and I, Deep Miner here. We got a nice little gathering going on here. We have family to the show. We have our heroes to the show tonight, Thomas. And again, Thomas, we talk about music all the time. And, you know, we've been able to have people on the show that we love and we appreciate. Tonight, we have our brother in music, Mr. David Austin, who is here hanging out and talking to our hero. This young lady that we're going to be speaking with tonight has definitely been someone who's been very instrumental in my musical landscape and my upbringing. What you say to that?
Absolutely, D Minor. You know, the reality is we love music from all across the country, all across our culture. But when we were young growing up, right here in California, there was a California sound that was coming right out of California, and especially that Los Angeles sound. Mm-hmm. And the lady that we have on with us today is quintessential to that LA sound that really shaped our young childhood coming up and really extended into our high school eras and far beyond. The music was sampled and the influence that was going on from all that stuff. And we're talking about LA's own, of course, the finest Miss
Patrice Rushen.
Yes, indeedy. And if I can piggyback onto that, as I said earlier, you were definitely one of the forerunners of being a female productionist, a female writer, arranger, producer. Aside from Tina Marie, Chaka Khan, Sheila E., not to take anything away from people like Aretha Franklin, but you really definitely set a milestone for my generation, because at that particular time, I'd say 78 to early 82, you know, the industry was very pop, R&B, and especially rock and roll, it was very male-dominated. And to have you come out and like, no, this is my band. I don't work for them. They work for me. You definitely changed the game. I'll never forget seeing you the first time on Soul Train and just being like, that's what I want to do and that's who I want to meet. I mean, some of my already girlfriends even ended up looking like you because I wanted to date Patrice Rushen. But in any case, we're so very, very glad to have you and for you taking the time to do this. And I must tip my hat again to the dynamic duo, especially Damian Minor, who I begged and pleaded with. Didn't have to pull too hard to see if I could try to make this happen, to do a radio stint with this. So we're honored and again, very happy to have you today.
Thank you. Well, it's really my pleasure. My pleasure to be with you and, you know, get into whatever it is that you guys would like to talk about.
Okay, well, I'll let the fellas start first because I got a laundry list, so I'll let them go first.
We all, as you can see, are an admiration of your music, and coming up in the early 80s and having it reach us the way it reached us. But we're curious a little bit about your upbringing, and we know that you were raised in L.A. Mm-hmm. and you grew up in L.A. What was your first introduction to music?
Well, my very first introduction to music would be just being around the house. My parents played the radio all the time. That was just part of the atmosphere back then, you know, because especially African-American people, we got our information from the radio. Mm-hmm. That was the internet then. There was no internet. So that was how a lot of information, your news, your music, your sports, blah, 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 and television. So I was never without either of those two things. And so my first recollection of liking music came from just hearing so much of it around all the time. Then you add to that the music of the church. You know, and what I was hearing there and the performances that were going on there. And mm-hmm. and then, you know, as I was growing up, again, with the radio and the kinds of people that I like to listen to, your Stevie Wonders and James Brown and Sly mm-hmm. Stone and, you know, these people, the Beatles, these people made a real impression on me, and I wanted to do that. I really wanted to do the music that people were doing on TV, mm-hmm. you know, the music for those TV shows. I wondered, who's playing that? I want to do that because it was so varied. There were so many different kinds of music that were represented. We had variety shows where you'd have everything from a circus act to the Temptations on the same show.
Yeah.
And so you got to see music. Of course, you mentioned Soul Train, and we had American Bandstand. Or in most places, there was some show where it was featured people's reaction to music that they loved. And I wanted to be a part of that. So, longer story short, I took piano lessons as a little kid, and I went through a program when I was in nursery school, the teacher there was very musical, and she knew about a program designed for kids and told my folks about it. And they said, okay, well, what do we do? And they took me over there, and I got into this program called the USC mm-hmm. Preparatory Department, where they were taking music education majors who were college students and master's students and allowing them to observe young children and teach young children and develop certain kind of theories about how much information these kids really had, what they could do to enhance this sort of innate ability. And we know now that early childhood development is critical.
Yes.
But back in those days, that was a new idea. Don't wait. Start supporting a person's passion early. So I was involved in that program, and that's where I learned to play the piano and met a lot of other kids who, some of whom, you know, as they've grown up, I've seen. I said, I think I remember that person, you mm-hmm. know, in some of those classes. And it was fun, singing and dancing and waving scarves to music, and they would ask us how the music made us feel. And that was really the development for me, is that part, how the music makes you feel. So for me, it doesn't matter what kind of music I'm doing, as long as I get something that I'm allowed to express, and hopefully people will feel it.
Do you remember that first feeling that music gave you?
Yeah, power. Power. Because the response to whatever it is that's happening is something that you really feel inside, and that element of power and control that those sounds, those frequencies coming together have, which is why I can weep at James Brown or Brahms, right? Mm. Because the power in the music is void of style. It's either there or it isn't there. And so, yeah, I remember that. I think that's why I was always attracted to movie music and TV.
The other thing that I think of immediately from your statement is, I see now they're trying to bring it back, but the majority of people that we get on, not everybody obviously, but the majority of people we get on where we highly respect their contributions to the American music scene, the Black music scene, say that they got that exposure either early from the church or early from the school programs like you did. Yeah. And I think people learning how to play the music, people learning the exposure to different instruments and timing and musical theory, et cetera, created musicians that really knew how to play their instruments and evolved into all different types of music. Do you think that that is something that has devolved today? Do you think that that's something that kids could benefit from to this day? Because we don't see it as much in the schools today.
Mm-hmm. The idea of Black music is the music of America.
Absolutely.
End of story.
Full story. It is pop culture.
So the rock and roll and all of the other things that were branches of the same tree, mm-hmm. started with the same ways in which music was cultivated in this country, you know, primarily from the experience of Black people.
Right.
Absolutely.
Now, the idea is that other things contributed to it. So don't get me wrong. It's not exclusively that. That's being a human being able to absorb different information and use it to be able to offer a certain kind of expression. That's what art is. But the roots of what it is that spawned all of these other things we've been talking about, mm-hmm. is definitely the same thing that came from those field hollers and the blues and gospel music and all of the jazz, especially borrowed from all of those things in terms of its identity and continue to be very expansive. And, you know, that aspect of who we are permeates through everything,
right,
that mm-hmm. you can see when you talk about the music that has come from here. So mm-hmm. now to your point about when we were coming up, those things were not, those were not things we didn't talk about. Those were things that when you were learning about the music and you were listening to the lady who was singing in church, you realize, or your parents or somebody would show you or tell you how the connection to your culture was just a part of it. Mm-hmm. And Black radio was huge for that same purpose. It wasn't like, you know, we're going to sit down and we're going to tell you. No, we're going to show you, because we're going to play Ray Charles. My time, my day, to be. And we're going going to play Aretha Franklin. And we're going to play Smokey Robinson. And we're going to play the Supremes. And we're going to play Little Stevie Wonder. And then you're going to turn the dial slightly and you're going to hear Miles Davis, John Coltrane, Sarah Vaughan, so on and so forth. And as you got, as during the time that I was a teenager, it wasn't unusual for us to be listening to Miles Davis. Followed by Herbie Hancock, followed by, you know, Clark Terry, followed by, go all the way back, followed by Ellington, and learned the progression of how we got there. So I knew, you know, that it didn't start with Sly. And just like kids now, the thing to teach them is, yet it didn't start with Bruno Mars.
Okay.
Or Beyonce. Or Kendrick Lamar. Then start there. There's a line that you can almost draw through that whole scene. So to your point about learning music and learning to play, you know, a lot of people avoid the idea because in school, what we used to have a band, it was just a band and an orchestra or a choir or something, because learning about music and being able to participate in something artistic was just a part of being human and having a good education. It wasn't necessarily special, except for the kids who made it special. And other kids made English special. And other kids made basketball special. And other kids made history special. It was a collection of information that allowed for you to be able to grow into being a good and an educated person.
Okay.
But it's work. And when you get to the point that it's like, you know, I like this more than it just being something to do, a hobby. And you start thinking in terms of maybe doing this as a living. We were exposed in Los Angeles, especially, we were exposed to the musicians who were faceless, nameless people who made tons of money playing the music for all of the films and TV and all the stuff. That was another level of stuff going on. We also saw music teachers. We went to the clubs. We would do field trips to hear the LA Philharmonic. And we would go to Shelley's Manhole. Our teachers, the teachers I had at the school I went to, would make sure that we had all of these different ideas and ways in which music was a vocation, a noble one at that, but that you had to be skilled and that we should be getting on with it. Mm-hmm. And we loved it. We had each other as a community. And we played all around town. And sometimes people would hear us and hire us later, you know, like some of our first gigs with Gerald Wilson's big band, or Willie Bobo was playing in town, or let us play. You know, all of these kinds of things would happen. But it was from learning the instruments and being serious about it and learning all the different aspects that are involved in a music career for a professional. And now I don't think you see as much of that. And I don't think you see as much of that because it's easier for anybody to do something for 30 seconds.
Right.
And fool everybody into thinking that that's covers all of the things that they are able to do. And, you know, it's not quite right. I don't know how fair it is. You know, I mean, there's a big debate about, is it fair for people who have done something for 30 years to have something who've done something for 30 minutes to have the same platform?
Right.
Right.
Exactly. Calling
you know,
these
so
objects,
there's always that debate. But I do think... To your point, Thomas, I do think that music disappearing from the schools, particularly our schools,
yes,
where creativity is just bouncing off the walls on all kinds of levels, to not have that as an option that is being pursued right then when the kids are finding themselves passionate about something and not having a way to be able to continue to express that and learn. I think that it has hurt.
And we are speaking with the queen herself, Patrice Rushen, on Let's Talk Music. This is 94.1 FM, KPFA, with our guest host, Mr. David Austin, Mr. Thomas J, and I, D Minor.
And we have our brother, David Austin, on. David, what say you?
Well, I say that, again, I'm ecstatic that we have a Miss Rushen, and I'm glad to slide up in here to have an opportunity to speak to you, you know, once again. But to piggyback off a question that he just asked, you were pretty much considered a child prodigy, you know, when you were a youngster. At that particular age, who took you up under your wing? And like I said, for me, you were Prince before Prince. You were the only artist I knew of that was a multi-instrumentalist. I mean, when the magazines came out, you were kind of like here, and he was kind of like here.
You know? I mean, it didn't take long for that to change.
Yeah, then times change, you know, times change, you know, on that little platform or ladder and everything like that. But I'm very interested to know, maybe this is a twofold question, who took you under your wing during the early days at Southern California University?
It was like a community of people, family of people. First of all,
okay.
You see, that was the misnomer, is that when you're exposed to music, that you're only exposed to one.
Mm.
Okay.
When you're interested in something, you might ultimately narrow it down to the thing that you like the best. But when you're exposed to something, it just grabs you from all sides.
Did you gravitate directly towards the piano, or did you have another instrument in mind?
No, I mean, I didn't have any instrument in mind. I was in this class, and we were moving and dancing around a room, and the next part of the course was you learn to play an instrument. And somebody said, want to play piano? Okay.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Fine. And then it became fun, you know, to be able to do something like that. But I digress a little bit when I tell you that, you know, I was a kid just like every other kid, and I saw my friends going to school, and the people in the band and stuff, they had a case. They were carrying a case. And I said, well, hip kids carry a case and play together. Piano, you play by yourself.
Okay.
And you don't have no case. You're not carrying a piano.
No.
So there was a point at which I realized, you know, when you're 11 and 12, you want to be just like everybody else. And I was realizing they don't practice before they have to go. They just go out and play. And my parents were like, hey, you got to put in your hour or put in your 30 minutes, whatever. And, you know, I realized that the big thing, and my parents were very conscious of, you know, of us as kids. And so they would say, well, the big thing is that you need to be around other people to play. So that's when I learned to play the flute.
Mm.
Okay.
So I could play at school and carry a case.
Okay.
That was my motivation.
Yeah.
But because I said, music grabs you from all sides. When I'm in the orchestra and I'm sitting in the middle, flutes sit in the middle of the orchestra, and I'm surrounded by all of this sound, the different combinations of the strings with the horns and this and that, and the percussion in the back, and then I'm playing with the clarinet and da da da. Oh, it was a game changer for my piano playing. It was a game changer for the way I listened to music. It was a game changer for me being able to discover this part. Why do I like Motown? Why do I like this piece by Beethoven? Why do I like this Latin music over here? Why does the lady at church move everybody to tears? It was the why part that came out of the experience of being able to play with other people. And that became a big part. So when you think in terms of mentors and such, I had many. My parents, first of all, because they were responsive. They didn't know, they were music lovers, but they didn't know how you get from one place to the next. So they were responsive. Other people who recognized, like in teachers that I had that were of a certain mindset, that it wasn't about becoming a musician per se. It was about using music as the lens through which you learned about life.
Right.
Okay. How did this lead to a record deal for you at such an early age? Because you got your first deal is in your teenage years, correct?
Yeah, I was just graduated from high school. I played the Monterey Jazz Festival of 1972. I was about to graduate from high school. And I had plans to go to college. And, you know, the last thing I was thinking about was a record deal. So, but at this festival where, again, in high school, we entered a contest. And you had the big band had a contest, jazz band had a contest, and then you could enter a combo. Well, our band, big band, didn't win, but the combo that I led did win. And the prize was you appear on the festival. So you appear at this festival, and all of a sudden everybody's talking to you about all these other kinds of things. You know, if they like what's happening, they talk to you about all these other kinds of things, and they were talking to me about record deals, and I'm like, no. I'm not ready. I'm not interested. Da, 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 da.
Okay, too soon.
So it took a year or so, but Fantasy Prestige offered a very small deal. I needed money for school. And the deal seemed to be cool, and they were going to let my high school teacher, one of my high school teachers, actually co-produce the first album, so there was a level of comfort.
Mm-hmm.
And it was easy because it wasn't overwhelming. So it seemed like a good fit for me. And that's how it happened. My first album came out on Fantasy Prestige in 73. And they heard me playing jazz at this festival, so that's what they wanted. You know, that's what they thought they wanted me to do. However, they were also really open because I could almost do anything I wanted to do. And as a composer, this was awesome because I could write and experiment with some of the new instruments that were coming out, synthesizers, etc. And as the albums progressed, the sound of the albums also helped me be able to sort of find this mix, which was actually representative of who I am. See, I'm recording jazz albums, but I'm dancing on Soul Train as a dancer.
Yeah.
Yes.
Same person.
Yes.
So they allowed me to experiment. And by the time I was finished with that label, Elektra came after me and they said, oh, we like the idea of you coming from a certain kind of musical tradition, but, you know, you're funky. you can, and therefore maybe be able to relate to an audience that is wider. And so then I said, this is great because this is allows me to be able to experiment with a lot of different things, which I did.
At this time, while in high school, were you running into a lot of your musical counterparts that would soon share success with you along the way, like let's just say the Johnson brothers or the Silvers family?
Charmaine Silvers and I were classmates in high school. And I knew about her, you know, her family and what they were doing, but I didn't. I was well out of school, as college days, I guess, when I was playing with the Silvers.
Okay,
but there were a lot, you know, that area spawned quite a few folk. Gerald Albright, saxophone player, you guys may have heard.
Oh, of course.
And he was Gerald Albright was in your band because I was watching a recent episode of Soul Train that you were on.
Yeah, he played in the band for a while. In fact. Okay. Forget Me Nots is Gerald's first professional recorded solo.
As we know it eloquently.
We go back quite a way.
Okay.
And the Earth, Wind & Fire, the guys that were playing horns in Earth, Wind & Fire.
The Phoenix Horns?
We were glad. Well, they're not the Phoenix Horns anymore. These are the guys that have been there for like the last, I guess, man, almost maybe 35 years. Mm-hmm. Going on, and they, you know, we were in high school at the same time. In fact, Earth, Wind & Fire as a band played my high school prom.
Was this when Doug Karn and Ronnie Laws and all those guys were there at the time? Or was this before?
Yeah,
like,
Ronnie Laws was there, and
Roland Batista.
Roland Batista was there. Uh huh. During that summer after they played my prom, they blew up.
They blew.
Okay. Yeah, so I've known them for quite some time. Paul Jackson Jr., the guitar player, played on all of Michael Jackson stuff. Just name a person and he's played on their stuff. So he was my neighbor. He lived down the street, you know, from me. So we grew up. So the community and the people in it and the kids who were in it who wanted to do music, that was really ideal in terms of an environment to support trying to be as good as you possibly could. We wanted to be so good that we could play with Miles Davis or Michael Jackson. Mm. And some of us did. So the idea is, again, the idea of a community that is celebrating excellence and creating ways in which that was the model that the students would see. And that's the model that we saw. And, you know, that and the fact that our parents were like, don't mess this up.
Okay.
We've worked really hard to get it to the point that you would have the opportunity should you decide to take it. But if you do, don't mess it up.
Yeah.
And, you know, we look back on it and we laugh. But at the same time, that was a part of the culture, especially for us. And if we were going to go outside of the lines of working at the usual kinds of, you know, noble jobs, but the art, all as soon as you say music or acting or painting or something, you know, people, oh my God, what are you going to, you know, how are you going to live? Well, it was about trying to not worry about that part, worry about being really good at it. Mm-hmm. And to be around a lot of people who were doing that, I think was a big part too.
Was this about you doing session work as well? I mean, because as you got into working with people like Prince and Gerald and so forth, and I'm curious too, are there any released singles or any material that you and him recorded together that we never got an opportunity to hear that may be locked in the vault that you worked on during the early 70s or early 80s?
Well, you know, we were all trying to do studio work. We were all trying to get to the point because that is part of what we saw. So we didn't see the fame part and being out front. That wasn't the focus. The focus was to do what you love, be good enough that that's what you would do. That it wasn't a side hustle to be a musician. It was the hustle.
Okay. Who were some
and
of the ones you loved working
And part of that was all the
with?
Different ways we saw professional people doing music. Some taught. Some played in clubs. Some did studio work and played on albums. Some did movies and film. Some worked in orchestras. Some worked in touring bands. You know, we saw all kinds of ways to do it. And you didn't have to, you saw combinations of the ways that people did it. So the point was to be good enough to do any of it. That was really the focus at the time. I the last thing I wanted to do was lead a band. Remember, I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to write. I wanted to compose for film and TV. Nobody would see me. Probably never. But the writing and contributing to that film or to that show or something like that, that's what, you know, I like to play. And as I learned to do that and got better and better at it, of course, a lot of other things happened. But the door I was trying to go through required a lot of other information, but there was the other information that allowed for me to be able to do a lot of different things. And many of us, that's the way it's gone down, which has been great.
Yes.
Did you get the creative freedom that you desired? So you went from jazz to electric and they're more of that funk LA sound that we know you for, but was there a lot of input that you were given or were they trying to produce you and say, we want you to stay in this kind of niche here?
No, at first, no, I had complete freedom to do whatever it was what I wanted to do. The best part about that was that as the music got out there a little bit further, you know, in having certain attributes that allow for it to be played at different radio stations other than only the jazz stations, you know, the audience accepted that. They really liked it. So I didn't have any problem. I was able to do pretty much what I wanted to do. I didn't get any pushback until Forget Me Nots.
Mm. Oh, please
That's
get into that.
That album, Straight From the Heart, was the one where I experienced pushback.
Mm.
And we were told, there's nothing on this album that we like or that we can do. Now that album has Remind Me on it.
Remind Me. Yeah.
Forget Me Nots is on it. Number One is on it. Where There Is Love. You know, there are a lot of things that
hits. Let's just tell it like it is, hits.
But the point was, that by this time, we had also learned about the business side of the music business and that one had to have a certain kind of access to that information also in order to navigate how to get the music in front of the people. Because, see, the people are going to decide.
Come
but
on, yeah.
They can't decide if you can't get it in front of them. And that's where radio became critical because you needed to get it to the radio level because that's how people were receiving the information. And people would decide, we like it or we don't like it, you know. And so that's what happened. But that's the only time that I experienced that kind of, whoa, we're going to have to take action to at least get it in front of people. The next time that I had that tug of war was when I did one album for Arista Records.
Clive Davis.
We had determined pretty much it looked like, based upon when we would play it for people, this looks like the trend of what people want to hear in terms of the single. But they weren't trying to do that. They said, no, we're going to find something for you. And it took them 3 years to find one tune.
Wow.
And that song, when it came out, radio was like,
"What is
this? Not from you. We don't expect that from you." And it wasn't like it was a bad song or anything, but by this time I'd already been out there so much that there was a certain expectation about what I would be offering, and this didn't, I guess radio felt like this didn't feel authentic to me. So those were the two times, you know, where I had to really make some decisions about how I was going to move forward and what constituted success for me.
Did Clive Davis bring you to Arista, or did someone else bring you?
No, he did.
Make that transition?
He did. My deal with Elektra was about 7 years long, and I did all of the albums. And at the time, just before I was ready to, you know,
make that
contract to end, he started talking to me about coming to Arista.
Okay. And we're speaking with the great Patrice Rushen now as we watch out on Let's Talk Music, 94.1 FM KPFA, with our special guest host, Mr. David Austin, Thomas J, and ID Minor. And we are having fun speaking with one of the greatest to ever do it, Miss Patrice Rushen. Miss Rushen, technology has advanced to higher heights. And now we have this thing called artificial intelligence, abbreviation AI. What are your thoughts on AI and the impact that it's had on the music industry and from an artistic perspective?
I've heard some things that it's like, it's amazing in terms of the kinds of things that it can do. But watch this. What happens when the perception is that recorded music and the way to do that doesn't have to involve
human beings.
You already got artificial artists out there. People, they really exist, but they're selling records. So I think that one of the things, again, to your point, Thomas, is that one of the last bastions for us is live music and being able to encourage people to not only go be exposed to it and hear it and support it, but that the musicians who are trying to be about that continue to begin to want to be master craftsmen. Stop. I don't know if the fame element is a result of something, as far as I'm concerned. It's a result.
Yes.
But the thing you're doing is the thing. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, how it goes. And, you know, when I was coming up, I didn't have to worry about how many friends I had on Facebook. I didn't have to worry about IG. I could just practice and play music with my friends.
Right.
And less worried about what other people think and what you like.
It wasn't exact. I think that speaks to sort of what we are hearing or not hearing inside of some of the music that we play.
And if I may validate you or toot your own horn in this specific category, Damien, just recently, as we both saw, as he was able to meet you and make this interview happen, Patrice is still a successful touring artist. She just successfully sold out, did the San Francisco Jazz Festival, and she is a working artist, not just a teacher, not just a professor, but her phone is still ringing. As they say in the industry, you still booked, baby. You are still very much booked. And I'm just curious, you know, with you still being booked in that sense, you recently did the 48th Annual Grammy Awards. You were the musical director. I'm curious of your association with Sly Stone. I know that you have admitted that you are, you know, are a fan of his legacy of music. But how did that come together, and how did you come? I was just blown away to see you on stage with Sly, and I saw you before I saw him walk out. So how did that come about, and could you give us a little background and backdrop on that?
Well, the Grammys, the years that I was doing it, they used to do these tributes. They didn't always do it, but they used to do these tributes, and they were gonna. They what they wanted was to reunite Sly and the Family Stone. That's what they were. That's what they were going for.
Okay.
But that group did not necessarily disband amicably. So it was already a challenge to try to get all of them in the same space, let alone will you play together this Grammy moment.
And can I ask, they wanted original members?
They wanted the original members.
So the Larry Grahams and Cynthia Robinsons and so forth like that.
Exactly.
Okay.
So the challenge was to be able to see if they would be interested and then get them together. So it was my job to figure out, okay, how do we pull this off musically from the standpoint of doing something that doesn't rely specifically on any one of them saying yes or no.
Okay.
So what we did do is we put together a medley that utilized Maroon 5, John Legend, and people who were at that time, you know, the new artists of the day, very influenced by Sly and the Family Stone. And then it segued into them being able to play together. And Sly, you know, didn't at the time, rest his soul, he wasn't necessarily the most reliable person in the eyes of the music profession.
Yeah,
because
I was curious, like, did he show up? I'd heard he did show up to rehearsal.
He came to rehearsal, and everything was cool. Now, Larry didn't make, because of a scheduling situation, Larry was only going to make the rehearsal day of show. He didn't come the night before. He was going to be there the day of show. Sly, was late.
Uh-oh.
And, you know,
okay.
Old school, you never late. Don't be late.
Yeah.
So Larry was there. He was on time. He didn't see Sly, and he went, I'm out.
Hey, I don't recall seeing Larry Graham on this particular show. Okay.
He did not end up doing it. So he says, he's not here. I'm out.
Okay, because they got the basis from
left.
The Fresh Days.
Sly was trying to get in, but he was stopped at security. Because he didn't take the limo that they had provided for him. He rode the trike. Remember, he had a trike.
Oh, that three-wheeler big thing that he has, you know, that he drives
He rode
California.
That to the thing, and so he goes up to the security guard, who is, you know, 20 years old, and says, I'm Sly Stone.
Clueless.
Yeah, right.
As to who he is.
So he was late because he was trying to get in. Anyway, long story short, he did play the show. And for me, it was like a kind of a full circle moment because I had, you know, I'd been a fan of the band when I was a kid. But, of course, I had had a chance to meet him in other situations. He was producing a group at a studio where I happened to be working, and we had a chance to talk. And that's what I remembered is how nice he was to me, how on top of it he seemed to be with what it was he was doing. So this is years later, and it's like, wow.
Okay, so
but it was quite an experience,
and
he did it. He did his job. He came in, and he knocked. It was really a pleasure to get to know a little bit Cynthia, who played trumpet in the band, and get to see Rose and Freddie Stone, because their lives had all evolved and changed a little bit, and the intersection was interesting to see the kinds of things that they had done or since then.
They were revolutionary and evolutionary for their particular time. And that's why I call you the princess of jazz fusion, because for me, like I say, you really represented bringing that jazz and R&B together. You made records like a Quincy Jones, you know?
Well, they're
timeless.
That's one of my heroes was Quincy Jones because of that fact that the musical language was things that he could manipulate so easily, you know, and a major and a craftsman, you know. Like Quincy Jones, only person I ever seen sit down with a blank sheet of music paper and just go and start writing stuff out for people to play and stuff like that. I was like, whoa. So it wasn't just the idea of his persona, his personality of able to galvanize people and bring people together. He was also very, very highly skilled.
Well, you were highly skilled as well. Like, I was always curious, like, how did your association with DJ Rogers come to take? Because I know he had a deal with Columbia Records, and he was a solo artist, but I knew him more in the gospel vein as a gospel artist. When did that transition happen, and how did you guys kind of get together to decide to kind of do a duet on Giving
Well,
Up?
We had a couple of mutual friends. One of the people who was involved in the production of my albums was named Reggie Andrews. Now, Reggie Andrews happened also to be that one of those high school teachers I was talking about.
Oh, okay.
And so when we were doing these albums, we had this thing. I wanted to do a duet with somebody. And he says, hey, how about DJ Rogers? And I, you know, I knew who that was. And I knew, you know, that, hey, that would be cool if he would do it. And he said, yeah.
Were you, I mean, because you were mentioning Elektra earlier and Prestige. First, you were on Prestige and then Elektra. Now, me coming up, Queen, of course, Grover Washington. I think they had the Reddings at one point. It was predominantly like, you know, the Doors. They were known as a soft rock label or just a rock label. When you joined the label, did you bring Prestige to Elektra? Did you kind of big them up as far as getting them more into the pop market or the R&B market?
I don't know. You know, I think they had, you know, I don't know the story exactly of how it happened, but I know that it was probably an identity with that being a successful boutique label. You know, you mentioned they had the Eagles, Linda Ronstadt. They had folks.
And what do you mean by boutique?
So this
now?
Was an idea of, because it was small. They focused on a certain kind of pop music.
Okay.
They weren't everywhere.
Trying to sign everybody.
They focused on a certain kind of pop music. They were going out. They did that. And very, very, very successful.
Okay.
But at the time, somewhere along the line, perhaps it was a corporate decision. Perhaps, you know, somebody felt like they could bring something different to the table. There was the precursor to what it is that you're talking about was called Quiet Storm.
Yes.
And it was music
Smokey
that
Robinson's
was
Quiet
of
Storm.
A commercial level, but also had elements of jazz. Well, that became what they wanted to experiment with a little bit. And it was a guy named Don Mizell who said, well, I think I know the kinds of people that would be able to bring a certain, you know, make this happen. Mm-hmm. So myself, the Blackbirds.
Okay.
Grover Washington Jr. Mm-hmm. Lee Ritenour. Dee Dee Bridgewater.
Oh,
we were
yeah,
all signed
okay.
right around the same time. As I guess we represented in what we were just doing naturally, the idea of being able to open up this thing and be able to do music, you know, that was true to our pedigree in terms of skill, but also where we had commercial sensibilities. And that it feel natural, not that you were superimposing one thing on top of the other, that it felt natural. And that's what gave me, you know, access. And the budgets were bigger. So when I needed strings, I could say, ooh, what I chose to do was if I needed strings, then I would write them. I needed to write for them. Remember, I'm trying to be this film composer over here. So I would use my albums as ways to be able to learn how to make things larger, smaller, blah, 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 blah. So I learned quite a bit during that time, and I got zero interference. Zero. Until we got to Forget Me Now.
I know for a fact, like, I remember you when you were on Soul Train with the Sugar Hill Gang, and that's a question that I asked too. I'm curious how that transition of hip-hop coming into the industry affected your career, or if it had any effect at all. Mm-hmm. Who was...
Well, I would say no, it had a profound effect, and a good one. When it was about an expansion on an art form in that way, which covered and focused on the things the kids did have access to. They had access to rhythm. Everybody couldn't play. They had access to rhythm, and that creativity has to go somewhere. So to be able to do that, to be able to use language, to be able to use our particular brand of language and put it into a situation where people could dance or anything like that, that wasn't unlike what bebop was.
Right.
Yes.
Bebop was a reaction to jazz having become, in terms of the big bands, having become formularized to the point that they were always playing the same thing. And bebop was, okay, when we leave here and finish playing what we playing for the dance floor,
mm-hmm.
we're going to go over here and play some music that's about us and the street.
Yeah.
We feel.
Yeah.
The
blah,
jam
blah, blah.
Sessions, well, as they used to call it.
Hip-hop was a very similar mindset. Use what we have to be able to say what we want to say. Yes, we are sampling because we are accepting of the tradition of what it was when we had access to be able to play. But since we don't, we'll take that and then we'll superimpose this other stuff on it. So when hip-hop was poetry, when hip hop was about feeling, when hip hop was about a certain truth, it was art. But what did I tell you a little while ago about what happens when the money gets in it?
Yeah.
That sometimes it changes focus and the priorities at its core. Now, I have a very big success story with the idea of being able to take music that exists and sampling and doing something else with it, and that's called Men in Black. It's the MIBs.
They come to MIBs. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I ain't mad. I understand exactly the idea of it, and I'm thrilled that the music that I had done was relevant enough to create the musical bed for this other opportunity. Well, that's what we're supposed to be doing. This.
Right. Growing.
But now, you know, they've lumped all of hip hop and rap into one thing. Mm-hmm. And a lot of what's being perpetrated as being what it's supposed to be is not what it is.
Not that. Not at all.
And the confusion is because since it was already new and growing, and that it was part of a certain population that was really understanding what it was at its core. But that population has grown into a lot of different people all over the world. But again, part of what's missing is the part about where it comes from and why. So now it's a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy.
Right.
That situation, the meaning gets diffused a little bit.
So you don't mind them sampling some of your stuff?
I don't mind them sampling some of my stuff, and I want to hear how they're going to use it. So I always ask, well, what are you going to do?
What you going to do?
I've had situations where I've said no. I had a song called Settle for My Love.
Yeah.
That love ballad.
Okay.
And somebody actually sent me and wanted to use it as a sample, and the first lyric was, relax, and take off your clothes.
Okay.
So, that's not to me a use that I feel good about. I don't want to be called out of my name. I don't want you calling other women out of their name. I don't want you calling brothers out of theirs. I don't appreciate that. If you need the music that bad, then you need to go create your own, because this was not created to be that. And you know, maybe, you know, it's easy for me to be able to be identified now as being old school and all of that other kind of stuff. But I don't think humanness and decency is old school. And I don't think that there's a timetable or an expiration date on true artistry in whatever form it takes.
Yeah.
It's got to be based in a certain truth that resonates. And that resonation has nothing to do with finances.
Okay, that's a powerful statement you just made, and I appreciate you saying it.
That album sold me. The movie did well. So financially, as it says, and in that particular instance, you didn't have an issue with it, and you gave us a brilliant example of when you did say no. Sounds like you were fortunate enough to be in the position to have that vetoing power. How does it affect your fellow artists, or maybe even yourself, if you ever face a situation where people do use your music? Whether that's for a commercial promoting something that you don't endorse, or that's a rap sample that created the song that you had no approval of.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're supposed to always get permission, not supposed to put it out without being able to get permission for, you know, and that can be the form of a sync license if it's used for a movie or license. You know, this is what I'm telling you in terms of how we, the musicians, the artists, the advocates for the music.
Mm-hmm.
Need to also know what's the playing field look like in this bit on the business side a little bit, so we know when we are supposed to have access to royalties, or we know when we're supposed to have access to permissions and things like this. It behooves us to know, because if you don't ask,
they don't say.
There's been situations that, you know, you have to go back and say, well, now wait a minute, and you know, then it's court and musicologists and lawsuits and everything to take this song and lay it up against that one and blah, blah, blah. I've been through that too. It's just easier if everybody understands, hey, ultimately we are one community of people that have many different ways to represent what it is that we want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Let's be fair to each other so that we can all be doing it by just getting permission, letting you know, blah, 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 blah. See, in most of the situations where you say, where I've had to say no, you wouldn't want it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You wouldn't. You would not buy, you knew you would not buy it, and you would not have your kid out there singing this lyric. Yeah. You wouldn't do it. So it's like the ones that are asking, usually now that we know that that's the practice, it's not as much of an issue, you know, to be able to try to be able to get the permission. And therefore, the creators always have the opportunity to say no. They don't always take it. But the access to being able to say, well, I don't think so, or if you have to change this, or I don't know, you know, it is there. It's interesting, though, because the tighter the legislation becomes with asking that permission, it seems the easier it is to say yes, because the people that are coming at you for the right reasons and usually are trying to be respectful with the way that they are going to handle it.
Do you find it easier for you to get royalties through streaming, or was it easier to get your royalties?
Oh, it was easier before. Much easier before.
Okay.
At least, first of all, there was the admission that they had to pay something. Did we get our fair piece of the pie? Not always. That's what you were always in trying to negotiate a bigger slice of that pie. But there was no question that it was easier. Streaming, you're making 0.0. You're making nothing. Nothing. Another interesting aspect and the way of thinking. See, is the I'm not anti-technology, but look at my room. I've no way. You know, I'm not anti-technology by any stretch of the imagination. Yeah. But the idea of using technology is supposed to make things easier, better, faster, and more precise in terms of how you do what you do.
Okay.
And I didn't think that it also meant cut out people, get rid of the, you know, we'll figure out how you do what you do and then right. We'll have a machine do it instead. No, that's not what's happening. And I don't think that's ultimately, I think that there's going to be some governors on that. But,
okay.
You know, at the same time, you know, we can't allow, just like you wouldn't allow somebody to just come up and just hit you in the face.
Right.
I don't want you erased.
The first thing you're going to say is, ouch. And then you're going to say, why'd you do that? Yeah. Before you hit them back.
Right.
Most of the time. What? You know, if the circumstances don't give you the why, that's the question you're going to ask. And I think that's part of what we need to do in all of our various ways in which we enjoy art and enjoy music and express music. Yeah. And advocates of the music are the ones that are going to really suffer, because that means that the level of what you guys love is just going to go this way.
Yep.
Instead of this one.
Well, a lot of people were screwed out of their publishing to the point where, you know, they didn't have the ability to say no on how the music was utilized. It was used in a commercial to sell X product, or if it was used as a sample somewhere else. I'm curious, with your musicianship and understanding of instrumentation and music theory and chord progression, et cetera, what is the level from specifically Patrice Rushen? What do you feel constitutes a sample versus an interpolation versus just coincidental chord progression?
I don't know. You know, it's hard to quantify. We have 12 notes, and they're everybody. You know, it's the same 12.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think intent is a big part of it. And you know when you sample something and you ain't played none of it and don't know what it. If somebody said, well, can you play it for me right here? Or can you tell me what chord that is? And you don't know, you know, if you've taken it or whatever. It's not the idea of doing that. I think it's the intention of what it is and realizing that, you know, we make no progress if we don't right. set a standard for being able to continue to be creative.
Mm-hmm.
See, there's a difference between choosing to do something because you just have that choice and you want to, and choosing to do something because you can't do the other thing.
Wow. Okay.
No, I agree. And so I asked this question because I do work with a group of kids in music production, and, you know, modern day hip hop is what most kids are interested in nowadays, and I'm exposing to as much music as possible. I was only curious because there are examples of in just music, Men in Black, because that's a song that most people understand. They took Forget-Me-Nots, and, you know, the lyrical melody and the musical melody, all right there is very clearly Forget-Me-Nots. But there are also instances where someone might take one chord or one note of Patrice Rushen singing a certain song, pitch it way down, put it through some processing, and there's something completely unidentifiable. So as a producer, they feel one way. How would you as an artist feel about where to, where you feel like absolutely not, this represents me, or vice
well,
versa?
Again, I think it depends on the intent. You know, the use and how they do things is another ball of wax to me. But if you know that you took it from me,
sure,
you need to tell me.
Yeah.
That's all.
Yeah.
Just tell me.
Right.
We can determine to what extent, you know, it's not a one size fits all situation at all.
Right.
I've had things where people have taken stuff and turned the phrase completely around, surrounded with some other stuff that's happening. But I'm gonna let you hear it and give you credit for this and work out the licenses and all of that kind of thing. I've had other people that just lift the whole thing and do something amazing with it. You know, I've had all kinds of things and shades of gray.
Mm-hmm.
But you gotta ask. You gotta say something.
Yeah.
And that's just manners and right.
Okay.
And morals.
Agreed.
and good sense and good business. If you ask me and it's cool and I say, yeah, go for it, or hey, we can work this out, you know, such and such and such and such, and work it out, that means you can come back to me.
Yes.
That means you can ask me something else. You know, Patrice, I know you so-and-so. Could you, what about a little solo right on top? But
yeah,
you can't
come
back to me if you didn't ask me. Don't come back. You stole it from me. Don't come back. You know, so I think the intent, I think, is the big deal.
You got three handsome men right here that got your back on that. And, you know, even if it came, you know, we're going to make sure that you get your credit
get
on
your
that.
Coins.
Okay.
Get your
coins. For real. This is 94.1 FM KPFA. Yes, we are speaking with the great Patrice Rushen and with Thomas J., our very special guest host, David Alston. And I am D Minor. Now, Patrice, I want to take it back a bit and ask you about how was it in working with the great Skip Scarborough? How was that experience for you in collaborating with him and then also being in the fabric of Confunction and Scarborough?
Well, Skip was like probably in terms of me understanding that songwriting is a vocation.
Mm.
He was the first person close enough to me where I could see that in practice. You know, other people say, you know, what you do? Oh, well, I'm a songwriter. And, you know, yeah, they got songs on this people's record and this person's record and so on and so forth. But he was close enough to me, a little older, but close enough to me where I could know that he wrote every day.
Mm.
From a certain time of day to the certain time of day, that's what he would do every day. Just like we practice playing music. Just like we practice scales or anything. The songwriter writes every day. And he placed a lot of things with a lot of artists, and then being Black, you know, we were closer to being able to actually watch and identify the groups and artists that he would write for. And sometimes he would be, I'm working on this. He would show me something or whatever like that. So he was, in terms of like a songwriter, the person that I was closest to early on, where I could actually see that this was not a fly by night, every now and then kind of thing.
Yeah.
What do you do each day? I get up and go to work. I write. Then there was the part about placing it and all of this other kind of thing that he was able to. So, no, it was masterful. And he was a nice guy, really quiet, you know, just except when he was writing. All the energy and power in his messaging and his lyric and his chords and the way he did things and the feel came out in his writing.
That Spirit of Love album by Confunction is by far, I think, their finest hour. And just hearing you all over that, hearing you on that, it just was definitely exuded love.
Well, that's one of those situations where I was called in to do a session, and I didn't know who I was going to be working for.
Okay.
And when I found out it was Confunction, it was just coincidental that I knew them, you know, or knew of them. Mm-hmm. So see, it's things like that that happen all the time. And you're like, you know, I guess the way to relate to it for people who don't play music is to try to find analogies that they can relate to. And because we do music, you know, and it always looked like we're having a great time. And we are. But what people didn't see was the work that got you to the point that you could be in there and make it look so easy. I liken it to somebody who plays doctor and somebody who is a doctor. So when you show up and somebody says, hey, doc, you're expecting that when they tell you you're going to need this treatment or need this surgery.
Right.
That they are going to put you with the best. And if they're not a surgeon in that thing, that you want them to put you with somebody who that's what they do every day. Right?
Right.
And they didn't miss class. Well, for me, art and music is like that too.
Yeah.
And when you pay your money to go to see somebody, you're expecting to have an experience. And if you go to see that person, or you go out and you buy somebody's CD or album or whatever it is, that you, and especially people doing it in vinyl, you want to sit down and have
yes.
a little ceremony. Because you're making an investment. That's one of the other things about the technology. It's like we don't feel that kind of investment unless somebody goes and purchases vinyl and has something to open and look at. See, that used to be the rule. When you bought the new Stevie Wonder, you didn't even have to hear it. You just go get it, right? You tear the paper off and you sit down. That's what I'm talking about, see?
Okay.
And you put it on a turntable and you sit back. And if there's information where it was recorded, what year, who's playing on it, I mean, this was golden. But now, you know, we don't do that anymore. And that, too, I think has taken away, you know, from the enjoyment and people feeling like it's easy. No, it looks easy and it sounds easy. And it's supposed to. When you master something, it is the ability to make it look very easy.
This is Let's Talk Music with our special guest, Patrice Rushen, and our guest host, David Austin, with Thomas J. and I, D Minor. We don't have too much time with you, but we just, this is such an experience. And for David Austin and Thomas J. and myself, D Minor,
yes,
just,
it is.
Yeah. I mean, I'm
speechless.
Well, thank you for giving me a chance to talk about it. You know, people see me. But this kind of not the kind of stuff they want to talk about.
Well, I mean, you got in detailed about the industry, your likes, your dislikes, and just how it formulated your life. You have had a love of music for several decades, and we cherish you and we cherish what you do. And what I wanted to really bring you on for was just to showcase the fact, like I say, you are still a working artist. I thought it was so eloquent the way that you just mentioned how AI may or may not be taking away from the artistry. I mean, I just even wonder myself now, when you work with somebody like a Charles Mims, your buddy's early songwriting partners, were your productions or your songs already pre-written and then you came in and let them embellished on top of them? I mean, were they already? Because, I mean, you were on the charts with the Michaels and the Chakas and, you know, the artists of that particular time, Confunction and so forth like that. So you were competing. You had heavy competition. So was your product already done when they came in? Or did you, you know, call them up and say, hey, I need a little bit of something right here?
Well, so it would vary. Sometimes the music would come first and I would want to do lyrics and get stuck. And I said, oh, I bet so-and-so can help me with this. Or they would come with, hey, have you thought about an idea that might be like this? There was a collaboration and we were always in the same room at the same time.
Mm.
Okay.
We did that when we were recording too. We were all there. Those records, we were all there at the same
live
time.
Live recording.
That doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah, I was just about
you go
to say,
in,
you don't
and
get
one or two
no
people
more.
In somebody's kitchen or garage or somewhere.
Yes.
You know, or something like that. No, we were all in the studio together and that meant that everybody had to have a
stay
certain
focused.
Kind of musical ability.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason you would see the same names on certain records and things like that is because people could see the music on a paper, if it was on paper, and be able to interpret what the artist wanted and what the artist needed or whatever. And see, a lot of I was playing on the tracks anyway.
Right.
So that, I think, is another thing that has changed the idea of the music making, is the idea that, you know, when you were creating a groove, you needed other people.
Yeah.
Yes.
Did you ever give a song away that you wish you had a cap? That you wrote,
no.
originally wrote?
I, no, I didn't. I don't think so.
Okay.
No.
I was
like I said, my writing was usually in collaboration with people that I really love and that I really have fun with. And when we were recording my albums, we were recording the albums with that same love and that same sense of fun. And, I may be the one leading the charge and it may be my record or whatever like that, but everybody had to contribute at the highest level.
Okay.
And we had to get past each other.
Yeah.
You know, like, well, hold up. You know, and we weren't afraid to do that because of the respect of everybody that was there. So, you know, we were all trying to do something. The music at that time, for its time, was so different anyway. So we just had fun.
I want to ask a question. I know the guys might have a question apiece, but I want to get in here and ask from an artist perspective and working perspective, how was it in collaborating with Wallace Roney?
Oh, man. Well, Wallace, I had heard about him way before I met him because, you know, he was, one of the people that the jazz community was really watching as he was really developing really fast and was beginning to also take on the next progression of a certain style that had kind of evolved out of Miles Davis. So everybody was kind of watching, you know, when he called me to play, he had already been working with another excellent jazz pianist at the time, Jerry Allen, you know, and they ultimately married. And I know that they split up and blah, blah, blah. But the idea was his level of musicianship and level of knowledge and the people that he wanted around him had to have that too. Very nice person and, was always very supportive. And I enjoyed playing with him. Life cut off very short. But I learned a lot just being in his presence, and it was a lot of fun to work with him.
Thomas?
Well, I'm long-winded, so I'm gonna just keep it short. But I thank you for joining us, and I could talk for hours and hours. And I just wanted to ask, I guess, perhaps a cliche question, but is there one artist that you still would like to work with that you hadn't had the chance to work with?
That's a loaded question. That's so hard. There's so many. There are so many. I'll name a few, and this list is much shorter than it is, for real.
You can give us the full spectrum.
we don't mind at all.
I can't think of everybody at once, but I have not had the pleasure of yet playing with Wynton Marsalis. Now, I say that because Wynton represents other sides of the music than particularly jazz, where his mastery of his instrument is amazing. And so we haven't worked together yet. His brother, Branford Marsalis. Now, Branford, I actually met first. Okay. And we haven't really played together yet. Okay. Man, there's so many people. I've been able to work with quite a few people that makes it that much harder because everyone I've wanted to work with, I've almost have done or had the experience. So, you know, now I'm doing a lot of different kinds of things too, and I'm meeting artists who are in a different area of the music at a certain level. And I've been writing like symphonic music. I just got back from New York where Juilliard pre-college orchestra just did the world premiere of a piece that they commissioned from me. So there's that too. I'm meeting artists in that area and conductors in that area that are giving me, an added platform of expression. But those are the two people that come to my mind the fastest. I haven't done a lot of work with Dede Bridgewater. I would love for us to collaborate on something. Yeah. We know each other, you know, pretty well. I had my opportunity to do some stuff with Prince, which was great. I did not have as many opportunities to do things with Michael Jackson. I know that, you know, people like Beyonce. And we mentioned Bruno Mars a little earlier, you know, and they're reaching a certain level now I think of musicality and understanding that it would be interesting to see, you know, what we might get into together. But I have lots of opportunities. There's no shortage of people that I would love to work with, because there's so many people that are out there that are really, you know, doing the thing, doing what they're supposed to be doing in terms of the growth and the area and stuff. And I hope that it keeps going with the young artists that we now see who are like at the top of the charts today. I hope that the idea of that, the privilege of doing music isn't lost on them while they're, you know, doing their thing and being famous or being a star or whatever it is that they were aspiring to. I hope that they're also looking at how that should give them major access to be about something, because someday you wake up and you're not at the top of the charts. Or someday you wake up and you're at a certain age and it's like, well, what do I have to show for it now? And what am I going to do with the rest of the days that I've got left? So some of that kind of stuff, I hope, is also part of the consciousness. And you guys, what you do is critical, because you have a critical part, a critical role to play in leveling out this idea of the consciousness of what it is that we do. You got nothing to play or nothing to produce if you don't have people who can play and sing and write.
Exactly.
What do you produce? In terms of being able to promote the music, in terms of being able to focus people's attention on good, better, best, that's you guys.
Yeah, thank you.
So, yeah, you have the right to be able to say, that's not happening. That is, here's why we should be all aspiring to that level.
Okay. And then David.
Okay, I'm just going to end with this. What I've always been curious about, was the song Never Gonna Give You Up, was that written for somebody else, and was it written in Oakland? Were you recording that in Oakland? I had heard that was written for somebody else, and then you kept it.
I don't remember if it was written for somebody else. I don't think so.
Okay.
Now, the Oakland moment that you're hearing is probably based on the fact that I used to do a lot of writing with Freddie Washington. Reddy Freddie, we call it, the bass player.
Yes.
Same Reddy person Freddy. Who co-wrote Forget Me Not.
Yeah.
Okay. And Freddie's from Oakland.
Ah, okay.
So you feel in a certain
vibe,
empathy
there.
And a certain feel.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent a lot of time in Oakland as well, you know, because that's where Prestige was, Fantasy. Right. That it was in that area. So I spent quite a bit of time up there too.
Where are you based out of?
Berkeley,
now?
Right, Steph?
Are you still based in Berkeley now?
No, I'm based in LA now.
Are you still teaching?
I am, but I'm not at USC. I left USC last year. I had done 12 years, and 10 of those 12 were as the chair of the popular music program there.
So
yeah, highly successful. And I wouldn't trade a day of it. I got so much out of being able to help to develop, be part of developing a curriculum for exactly the kind of music and that people wanted to do, but to be able to learn how to do it and to absorb some of the things that we've been talking about as part of the lessons that informs their music. So hopefully that lifts everything as they embark on their careers, because they're armed with knowledge and history. So it was a beautiful experience and one that I will never forget. And it informed quite a bit. And it also made me realize how fortunate I have been, because so many of the lessons and so many of the things that were developed into a curriculum were out of the experiences that I had and some of the other teachers had. So they're getting their information first and second hand.
From somebody that actually did
it. That was pretty
it.
Special for everybody.
Yeah, somebody actually did it. What do we have to hold for the future for Miss Patrice Rushen? Where does our queen go to next?
Well, you know, now that I'm beginning to understand now the idea of all of the things, the experiences that I've had, the musicians I've played with, the programs, the TV programs, the shows, all of these, you know, some of these things have created, an opening for me to be able to not necessarily be teaching in the classroom, but continue to use the platform of these things as a teaching platform. Mm-hmm. Every time somebody sees me do something, whatever it might be, I hope that they walk away feeling uplifted. I hope they walk away having learned something. And I hope they walk away just feeling something inside that makes them want to do whatever they do at another level. That's what I hope. And it shouldn't matter, but it does, you know, that, you know, we see a lot of people out there, but what are we taking away from them? So I'm hoping to keep doing things that allow for people to take something positive away from what I do.
You definitely inspired me and us today. I mean, you gave us a master class that I couldn't, you made a dream come true today for me. Little David is very, very happy. So I mean, I can go away happy now.
Yeah.
If he takes me today, I'm not happy.
And I have to say, I think for myself, and I think I can speak for the fellas here, this has been truly a spiritual experience. And
I second that, and
truly a blessing. Music, we live, eat, and breathe music. Your music has gotten me through some turbulent times in the sense of just what I've had to deal with in this thing called life. So I just want to say thank you for just everything that you've done. And yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing more from you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I appreciate all three of you. You know, like I said, it doesn't happen unless people are paying attention.
Yeah.
You know, and you can already tell, Thomas, you talked about the image before. Before we go, I'll just say this. One of the things that was so important to us, knowing, walking in with your eyes open, knowing that people wanted you to be acceptable.
Yeah.
In whatever ways that translates.
We understand.
The person you need to be acceptable to is you.
Yeah.
Okay.
So when we were talking about, well, what will we do? What can we do? And it was we, hear me now, it was a team of people where we talked about what was the image that we wanted to see that would offer a certain kind of consistency with what the music was going to represent, but mm-hmm. also that was me, that I could live with.
Yeah.
And when we came up with the idea of the beads and the braids and all of this, it came from us looking at the idea that music and doing it in the way that we wanted to do it was a noble profession. And we went through some art books and history books, and we got to people from African descent, blah, 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 and Africa, and we saw the adornment of what that was. It wasn't so much about anything superficial. It was about a certain self-understanding and realization of a certain way in which we could adorn ourselves that would hopefully initiate a certain kind of positive reaction and radiate more than just the person. So that's where the beads and the braids came from. I still wear braids today. My neck ain't strong enough to handle all them beads now, but back in the day.
we definitely thank you. You influenced a lot of young black sisters out there going out and double dutching with the beads and the clanking and the braids. Mm-hmm. Hey, that's my generation right there. So I greatly appreciate
you
that.
Started
a master class from Patrice Rushen. We are so thankful to have you with us on Let's Talk Music. There is a chair anytime for you. That you're in the area, you can always come back and join us. We'd love to have you on.
Awesome.
We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
I
hope to talk to you guys again.
Appreciate you so very, very much.
KPFA.